Hello, welcome to The Law Report. Damien Carrick with you. If you had to stand up and represent yourself in court, how would you cope? It's probably something we should all be thinking about because hiring a lawyer is expensive and legal aid budgets are under extreme stress. So flying solo in court is now becoming increasingly common. Today we're going to explore what it's like to be a self-represented litigant in our civil and family court systems, and also explore the impact these litigants are having on our court systems. Last week, John, not his real name, ran a three-day hearing in the Federal Circuit Court in Brisbane that resulted in a confidential settlement.
The experience itself, just to be able to stand in front of a courtroom and have your say, it is very stressing. It was confusing in the fact that not being a lawyer, to actually knowing the court process and what actually happens on day one and then the first part of day one, or then when there's a break and what happens in each part, in a part of the day, and then when you're being cross-examined, what you can say and what you can't say, being a self-representing litigant, you know, when do you object to their questioning? Like, all those sort of things I was unsure of, and so that became quite difficult to get through, I thought.
I presume the other side had legal representation?
That is correct. The questionings from the respondents was fine. The judge, when you are self-represented, the judge makes sure that they don't take advantage of your lack of understanding of the law process and things don't get out of control.
I imagine that questioning witnesses would also be quite a difficult thing for somebody who isn't trained.
It was, but you do have your affidavits that have been filed in the court to go by, so they guide your questioning, makes it more discreet on what the question is going to be asked about. So you don't have to focus about everything. It can be focused down into little chunks of information.
Now, what happened at the end of the three-day hearing?
We came to a settlement, an out-of-court settlement, which I was quite happy with, and the other party were quite happy with as well.
So a success?
A success for both sides, I feel, yes.
John, from Brisbane, not his real name. He acted for himself after a lawyer quoted him $20,000 to represent him. John, however, did get some guidance from the Queensland Public Interest Law Clearinghouse, known as QPILCH. It gave him limited assistance with discrete tasks like drafting documents or understanding the next legal step. Elizabeth Pendlebury is coordinator and federal court solicitor with QPILCH. She says self-representation isn't easy.
I think it's difficult. People often express frustration at the amount of time it takes to get litigation resolved. They also express frustration at the complexity of the rules. I think that in a lot of ways, self-represented litigants have expectations of the court system that don't reflect the reality of the situation. So there's a perception that if they can go to court and get before the judge or have their day in court, as it's often phrased, that everything will be all right. They don't expect to have to follow a lot of pre-trial proceedings and steps to set out their case before having a substantive hearing before somebody in the court system.
And do many self-represented litigants rise to the occasion, and are they able to represent themselves in an effective way?
It really depends on the litigant. It depends on how sophisticated they are themselves, how readily they wrap their heads around the information that we're able to provide. We do have a lot of litigants that run a trial themselves. We had one client who had a five-day trial after an 18-month process of getting there in a litigation with his brother, who was also self-represented. Property dispute, basically, after a falling out based on a shared investment they'd made. But he was able to successfully get orders and also then respond to an appeal that was brought later on.
What court was that dispute in?
That was in the Supreme Court and then later in the Queensland Court of Appeal.
And did he win the appeal?
He did, yes.
So there are people who can navigate the system well, but presumably there are many who must be incredibly frustrated. Can you tell me about some of those?
Yeah, a lot of people are frustrated at the delay and the amount of time. We do have clients who discontinue because they didn't realise what would be involved, and once we explain it to them, they realise they don't have the ability to be able to contribute the time that they'd need to be able to progress the case, particularly bearing in mind that recent research from the Justice Foundation in New South Wales has shown that disadvantaged people typically have multiple legal problems, and legal problems sort of beget legal problems, as it were. So there's a lot of things going on in these people's lives. So they might have lost their job, which led to their bank taking steps to repossess their house, which leads to litigation. And we do see a lot of people who give up rather than fight the battle, as it were, in the courtroom.
So you think people literally do have bad outcomes, they even lose their homes because they can't cope with being a self-represented litigant. And they might otherwise have a good case, that's what you're saying.
Yes, definitely. It's not just because they don't have a good case that they walk away.
Q Pilcher's Elizabeth Pendlebury. It's tough being a self-represented litigant, but it's also difficult for courts who have to deal with legal novices. Now, of course, most self-represented litigants are doing their best, but there is a small percentage that are described as querulous. Tanya Sorden is a professor of law and dispute resolution at Monash University. She's been researching this small group.
Well, in some cases, it's people representing themselves and commencing multiple proceedings in different jurisdictions. In some instances, they will simply not follow directions but delay to really cause grief to the other litigants involved in a case. In some cases, the behaviour can be so bad that it almost leads to stalking or other bad behaviour. And in some cases, really, they will present information which is incorrect or inaccurate, or behave in a way which makes it very difficult for a judicial officer to run a case in an appropriate manner and really to accord some dignity in terms of the processes that you're going through. And I think for some people who have behavioural and mental health problems, these issues are magnified. And it is extremely difficult. Some people who might behave quite rationally in an ordinary social or work setting may actually find that during the course of litigation, their behaviour changes and they're really not able to focus themselves or behave in a way which we would regard as being more rational.
Mm. Can you talk to some of the cases that you're aware of which fit this bill?
I think you really only need to look at some of the reported cases to see some similar names that come up again and again in the system. And there are some litigants who are declared vexatious or may in fact be declared vexatious for the purpose of some of the proceedings that they launch. But I suppose when I review court transcript and also decisions that are made, you will see that sometimes there's almost a baiting of the judicial officer, or the way in which the person talks to the person on the other side is so appalling that really one wonders how justice can be done under those circumstances.
Now, courts can decide that someone is a vexatious litigant and that can effectively bar them from our courts. How does that process work and how often does it happen?
It happens rarely in most jurisdictions because in the past it's been quite a difficult process to follow through. There are amendments proposed at the moment in Victoria which are trying to make it easier, if you like, to move these proceedings through at different levels so that you don't have to go up through the Supreme Court, but you can in fact make applications at the county court and magistrates levels. It's not a complete answer though, in that it only deals with part of the issue, and it is a very serious matter to in fact declare that a person is vexatious and prevent them from continuing or commencing court proceedings, particularly if they do have a legitimate claim which might be buried underneath some of the pieces that they've put in. And I think this is the difficulty as well, in that some of these more obsessive self-represented litigants may have a legitimate claim. It's just very hard to determine what that claim is and what should proceed and what should, if you like, not proceed.
Tanya Sorden, Professor of Law and Dispute Resolution at Monash University. Later this month, Tanya's a speaker at a conference on self-represented litigants, which is being organised by the Australasian Institute of Judicial Administration. Also speaking is Philip Misso, judge of the County Court of Victoria. He manages the damages list. This includes public liability, slip and trip cases, medical negligence, and also work and transport accident claims. He has to deal with querulous litigants on a regular basis.
And one of the features of them is that the way in which they set their case up is almost indescribable when it's compared to what a trained legal eye would see as a proceeding that's been legitimately presented, has a legitimate base, has law which supports it, not necessarily successfully. And unfortunately, the difficulty then becomes that they come before me, And I have to be the one to tell them that unless there is some rectification of their cause of action and it's produced in a conventional manner, there's an inevitability I'll be dismissing their claim. And what often happens then is the first letter of complaint, and I'm considered to be, in a sense, working against their interests.
Putting up a brick wall.
Yeah. And unfortunately, in some cases, it tends to spiral. They'll then consider that my associates are part of their sense of a building up of resistance to what they have no doubt is a legitimate claim. They often are in conflict with our filing staff at our counter. They will then produce, unfortunately, lots and lots of emails and letters directed to me personally, directed to my associates. Many of them have a belief that they will never shift from that they've got a righteous cause.
They're inflexible.
Totally inflexible. And then the day comes when the application to dismiss it is made, and I will say, look, I've given you three chances. I don't know why three. It's the old thing we're stuck with, three strikes and you're out. Well, I sort of work on that basis, and I think that's enough. And if I get to the stage where I think, well, look, there's no useful purpose to be served by giving you another chance, well, inevitably I'm thinking, I've got to balance you and your rights and giving you all the chances we can and the rights of the party who's your target. Inevitably, I'm afraid they end up having their claims dismissed. Some of them, I have to say, have got a basis, but it's very hard for them to winkle it out, tease it out, because the fight becomes against me, against my staff, against the filing people downstairs, and they start to lose sight of really why they're there. We try our best to help them, but we're starting, in a sense, with a lost cause before it even starts, if you follow me.
How can the courts better deal with these people?
I've got a method of a tendency to make orders which are, in a sense, unusual, where it's the roadmap I try to set them. If you do these things, this is the next stage you'll get to.
But signposting is very important, isn't it? Because it's about terribly managing people's expectations.
It's terribly important.
Let's now talk more generally about the great bulk of self-represented litigants, the people who perhaps, who are doing their best in very difficult circumstances. Do you think those people fare well in the system?
What we try to do is, by making the sorts of orders I described before, which are rather more the roadmap, we tend to do that very often, or certainly I do and certainly the other list judges do, so that the litigant has things that they can tick off. And I'll give them time to do it. I'm a little less tolerant if they don't, but I like to show a little bit of intolerance the second time round, because I think people need to be encouraged to move along, to come along and just shrug their shoulders and say, I don't know what to do and I haven't bothered to take any steps, is really unacceptable. But we now have a self-represented litigant coordinator. We have a video that we give the self-represented litigant so that they can visually, in an 8-minute video, which is short enough to keep people's attention, but very instructive nonetheless, about the court, who the plaintiff is, who the defendant is, how you prepare your case, what the expectation is, the things that you should familiarise yourself with, court rules and things of that kind. We have a booklet which we give to people. So we try to create that platform. But of course, the next thing is, if you look at the county court rules, you'll quickly put them down because they are fairly long. They're drafted in language that's there for the benefit of lawyers who understand this sort of language. It's very difficult for litigants to work out what that means. The law, well, the law is relatively well understood by me in the areas where I have some skill, but for a litigant who has a negligence claim against an employer, to understand what the law is and concepts of contributory negligence and trying to get medical reports from doctors who charge a fair fee for what they do. These people don't have money. Trying to subpoena medical witnesses, trying to handle all of this, the general things in practice and procedure, become almost impossible. What I and some of the other judges do, we'll lean on the institutional defendants and say, well, you can get this material, you can absorb the cost, we expect you to do these things and to give that to the litigants and the personal injury actions. So we can go some of the way down the track, but the point we stop, and it's a little bit grey, is we have to be very careful that we don't go too far, to actually be the advocate for the self-represented litigant.
We have an adversarial system, not an inquisitorial system.
So we have to be careful to preserve the position of the judge and not compromise the position of the defendant, the target of the litigation. And that's quite hard because I have sat there on occasions thinking, I think you do have a pretty good case. You just haven't had the means by which you can pull it together. Now, the particular problem occurs with litigants who don't have English as their first language. I can't help feel it's almost an impossible task, but we've had a number who have been rather aggressive about it and haven't done such a bad job.
They've won.
In one case I can recall that another judge did where I managed the case, the fellow did win. Yeah.
But generally speaking, they don't come off too well.
I don't know they don't. In fact, I would think in the majority of cases they don't come off too well. I might say that I'm talking about the damages list. Judge Marie Kennedy conducts the commercial list where people, I suspect, are probably better educated. They're in business after all. They understand these things. The law isn't so far removed from their daily activities, one would think. They tend to do a little better, I expect. But in the damages list, public liability claims where someone slipped or tripped, medical negligence claims, transport accident where there's someone injured in a car accident, an accident at work. That's the broad range of the central work we do in the personal injury area. But, you know, they're pretty tough cases to prepare and run.
Judge Philip Misso, in charge of the damages list in the County Court of Victoria. He says, in contrast, self-represented litigants involved in commercial disputes tend, in general, to fare better because business people often have the skills to navigate the system and to argue their case. You're listening to The Law Report on RN, today looking at self-represented litigants. So far, we've been speaking about self-represented litigants in the civil courts, but it's also a huge issue in the family law jurisdiction. Kate, not her real name, acted for herself when her ex-partner sought to vary the care arrangements for their children.
Well, it was obviously pretty stressful. So actually, I think the biggest problem was the fact that the other party did have a lawyer. And so I think he felt like he could push me around a little bit more than he may have if I had representation. So, I felt a lot of pressure from the other side.
Was it a lot of work?
It was certainly a lot of paperwork and sort of not coming from a legal background at all. That was a little bit challenging as well, to sort of trying to feel your way through it and obviously having to do all of my own research and, you know, make all the phone calls and things to make sure that I have had everything in place. But the judge was, magistrate, I should say, was very understanding of my position and did her very best to sort of explain everything in layman's terms for me, which I thought was pleasant.
And were you comfortable standing up in court arguing your case?
I was fairly comfortable, yeah. I thought the best thing is just go in and be honest and go from there. So I was very confident from that point of view, that just sort of to go in and make sure I was very truthful in all of my answers so that, nothing could sort of go wrong from that end, yeah.
And you succeeded. So you were happy self-representing?
If I'm 100% honest, I had to give advice to anyone else, I would say if you are able, that, you know, I would have felt much more confident having somebody who's professional to give people guidance in that area. I think that would have maybe not made the situation so stressful.
Was there anyone there to guide you on the day, to help you on the day?
Not on the day, no, but I did consult with a lawyer prior to going in who actually made me feel a lot better about the whole situation and talked me through it, and we sort of had worked out where the other lawyer was maybe sort of trying to push me in areas that he needn't have. So I think from that point of view that really helped with my level of confidence.
Kate, not her real name. The self-represented make up a substantial percentage of litigants in family law disputes. Mark Lepore-Trench is a Sydney-based judge of the family court.
The annual report published by the court for the 2013 year shows that in trials, a little less than 30% had one or more parties unrepresented, and across all the cases resolved by trial or otherwise throughout the court, probably about 33-35%.
presumably disputes take extra time because one party or another is a self-represented litigant and aren't really across the law and the rules. What sorts of areas do you see these sorts of blowouts?
Generally, in my experience, I can only talk for myself, where there's a case with a self-represented or unrepresented litigant, cases tend to take a shorter time for determination than longer.
A shorter time?
Yes, because they're self-represented litigants, by and large, are very contained and controlled in their word usage. That's for most of them. Of course, there are others that tend to be the other way, that are extremely verbose and perhaps have difficulty explaining in a logical and contained manner what it is they want, and framing questions that are one question at a time rather than three or four wrapped up into one, they can extend the time that a case would normally take.
Do you think that self-represented litigants fare as well as represented litigants in terms of obtaining an outcome from the court?
It would, I think, depend on what sort of case it is. In a parenting case, an applicant, whether represented or otherwise, with merit, in my experience, would achieve the same outcome whether they are represented or not represented. The other aspect of parenting cases is that they're less adversarial cases, and in a practical sense, judges take on a far more active role in those sorts of cases and would be required to inquire about, I suppose, areas which might be deficient in the evidence of an applicant self-represented, so that a judge might ask, you know, well, where are you going to house the children? Who's going to be there when you have the children with you? How are they going to get to school? Questions like that, which in a strict adversarial proceeding would not be asked.
So the judges are trying to tease out the merits of a particular proposal from the parties because they realise that maybe the self-represented litigants might not be putting their best foot forward just simply through lack of experience.
Yes. In a property case, though, that's an adversarial case. An unrepresented litigant in a property case could well fare differently if they are represented, because they have to put before the court evidence to support the orders that they're seeking. And if they don't put before the court evidence of their contributions in a manner in which the court can take those into account, then they're likely to be unsuccessful.
There's a lot of discussion about people who say that they've been victims of abuse or violence, and yes, if the perpetrators are self-represented, they might cross-examine the abuse victim. That sounds like a terrible situation.
Well, it is, but in a practical sense, depending on the relevance of the issue, the court has to deal with it. However, a judge controls a court. A judge won't allow a alleged perpetrator to further abuse somebody by questioning. And in those cases, as I said, the judge just has to control it. And you're perfectly right, it can come down to a situation where an unrepresented alleged perpetrator cross-examines an unrepresented alleged victim.
Eleanor, I understand you were cross-examined by your ex-partner in the family court. What was it like when you realised that this would happen?
It was horrendous. The whole situation for me, where I had taken some time to leave my perpetrator, it had been a very horrific experience being with him and then leaving him, and to then, after being brave enough to sort of take that leap and to get out of that situation, to cross-examine me directly was just horrendous for me. It actually stripped me. I felt like I was standing there and he was just had all of his power back. And even though his questions may not have seemed to have been that bad to other people, he knew which questions to ask. He knew how to press the buttons of trauma for me. At the end of the day, I walked out of there not sure whether I could actually face the court the next day. And I literally wanted to just throw myself in front of the first bus. It was that bad for me.
What did the judge do in these circumstances when he was asking you these questions?
The magistrate at the time had actually given him a warning before questioning me, saying just make sure that you ask appropriate questions. But at no time did they seem to show any concern or seem that it was even inappropriate for him to question me. And what was actually really bizarre for me was that we were in the exact same courtroom that only just over a week beforehand a magistrate had given a intervention order, which he clearly said that it was not safe for us to be in the same vicinity as each other. And for him to say that and then to be in the same courtroom and have another magistrate make the decision that it was appropriate for him to directly cross-examine me just seemed really absurd.
Eleanor, not her real name. Basana Mutha is the Policy and Campaigns Manager with the Women's Legal Service of Victoria. She says cross-examination by a violent ex-partner often frightens and intimidates survivors of domestic violence.
We do see that happening. We also see a lot of women who are faced with the prospect of going to trial and being cross-examined by their abusive ex-partner, and they choose to settle before trial. And I think that happens a lot, that they simply do not want to be unrepresented in court, and they will do everything that they can to avoid that happening.
So the prospect of being cross-examined by somebody that they say has been violent towards them effectively silences them legally. That's what you're saying.
I think that's correct. I think that they're not really given the opportunity to tell their story in court because of the prospect of being cross-examined personally by their abusive ex-partner.
What does that mean for outcomes?
It means that they may not get the best outcome that they possibly could get. If they're not legally represented, they have to negotiate an outcome, possibly with their ex-partner, and it may not be the outcome that they're looking for.
I heard on ABC local radio in Melbourne the other day of a case of a woman who was in a wheelchair because of the injuries sustained at the hands of her ex-partner. She fronted up to the family court and she was told that because her ex-partner was a self-represented litigant, her legal aid funding was going to be withdrawn. Now, in that case, her lawyer decided to continue to represent her without pay because I think the lawyer felt this was very important that he or she did this. But what does that case, as described on local radio, tell us about the issues here in terms of funding?
The situation is quite difficult in Victoria. So since January 2013, a revision to the legal aid family law guidelines has meant that if both parties have legal aid, both parties will lose their legal aid just before the trial. So it actually means that you have two unrepresented parties about to go to trial.
And if only one party has legal aid and the other one doesn't, does the one with legal aid have it removed?
Yes.
So this sounds like a very difficult situation. How would you like to see it addressed?
Primarily, there needs to be an increase in legal aid funding.
A difficult thing to argue for in this climate.
It really is.
What about changes to the actual law?
I think that in terms of the issue around self-represented person being able to cross-examine another party, in the family law jurisdiction, there aren't any legislative protections that actually protect vulnerable witnesses. And at a Victorian level, in sexual offences and family violence trials, they do have legislative protections. So a court can order an unrepresented party to be represented for the purposes of cross-examination. And so I think that there's real scope for that to be developed at a family law level.
Basana Mutha from the Victorian Women's Legal Service. That's the Law Report for this week. Next week, we'll be looking at how self-represented litigants fare in our local or magistrates' courts. Do visit us online at abc.net.au/rn. There you can find podcasts, audio on demand and program transcripts. A big thank you to producer Anita Barrow and also to audio engineer Gary Havrillay. I'm Damien Carrick. Thanks for your company.